Our first speaker, Matt Sacchini, his topic is the circulation of Mardi Gras Indian music in New Orleans. Matt has lived and worked in New Orleans since 1997, first as the co-producer of the public radio program American Roots, and then as assistant professor of music at Tulane University. Matt is an ethnomusicologist who researches festival traditions in contemporary New Orleans, especially brass band parades and Mardi Gras Indian ceremonies. He has published in the journals Ethnomusicology, Current Musicology, Space and Culture, Allegro, and the Jazz Archivist, has contributed to Mojo and Wax Poetics magazines, and filed reports for public radio's All Things Considered, Marketplace, and WWOZ's Street Talk. So, without further ado, Matt Sacchini.
All right, how's everybody doing today? Welcome back from lunch. It's hot out there. The heat, you finally brought the heat back to New Orleans. I think this conference is solely responsible. I'd like to thank Bruce Rayburn sitting up here in the front for suggesting that I present here at the ARS conference. Most of my work is ethnographic on contemporary New Orleans, but I'm at the Jazz Archives and other archives around New Orleans quite a bit studying brass band and Mardi Gras Indian music here in New Orleans. And I'd like to present today on the Mardi Gras Indians, a very distinctive local tradition here in New Orleans that some of you might know a little bit about or be curious about. And I'm just going to go ahead and take about 25 minutes to run you through some key recordings and try to build a theory of how significant these recordings have been in creating this tradition. At least since emancipation in New Orleans, African Americans have gathered together on Sunday evenings singing call and response chants and beating on tambourines and other percussion instruments. They refer to themselves as Mardi Gras Indians, and the origins of the tradition is not fully known, but some African Americans claim Indian ancestry in this tradition, but it's very difficult to pin down. And they band together into small groups that they call tribes or gangs, and that are organized hierarchically. Chiefs at the top, second chiefs and third chiefs, queens if there's queens in a tribe, and then spy boys, flag boys, wild men, almost replicating what they perceive as an American Indian tribal organization. These weekly practices culminate on Mardi Gras morning when tribes from neighborhoods all over the city march through the streets singing their chants and confronting one another with the goal of having a rival chief submit by bowing or kneeling. Until the 1930s and 40s, these face-offs were sometimes violent, and disagreements, which Indians call humbugs, were settled with hatchets, spears, or other weaponry associated with American Indian warfare. Indians were even feared by fellow African Americans, at least until the mid-20th century, when the violence dissipated and the status of the Indian as an uncompromisingly powerful man became achieved through symbolic competition. Research on the Mardi Gras Indian tradition is focused on two primary ways that Indians accrue status and respect as tribal members and especially as big chiefs. Indian suits, which are these unbelievable hand-sewn costumes made of brightly colored feathers and very intricate beading and rhinestone patterns, are recognized for their beauty. And the prettiest chief, as he's referred to, is admired for his innovative sewing and beading when confronting another tribe. One example of symbolic competition, and another is Indian talk, which is a kind of verbal sparring match in which chiefs literally try to bring another to his knees through the use of artful language. Another example of symbolic competition. What I want to focus on today is a third that gets far less attention, which is the music. The shift away from violence and towards sewing and talking helped transform the figure of the Indian from a fearsome symbol of violence to a celebrated icon of local black culture. And the main intervention I want to make today is that in addition to the costumes and ceremonies that have justifiably drawn so much attention to the tradition, that we listen closely to the music of Mardi Gras Indians as an entry point into understanding their significance, and especially the changing significance over the course of the 20th century. Above all, it has been singers who have been elected to represent Indian culture in performances, exhibitions, documentary films, and recordings that have circulated the tradition far beyond the city's back streets. Beginning in the 1950s, sound recordings of professional New Orleans musicians in the styles of R&B and then later funk and hip-hop, and then Indians themselves, beginning in the 1970s, these sound recordings created an extensive listening public for what had been a relatively secretive community practice. This coincided with, but was not coincidental to, a radical shift in public awareness and perception of Indians, when the tradition was unconcealed and its practitioners were glorified, especially those who could really sing. I'm not going to show any images of Mardi Gras Indians today, because I find when I do, it takes the entire 25 minutes of my talk for everyone to process how incredibly inventive they are. And I don't want to distract your attention away from the music, but I will play lots of musical examples as I try to provide social and historical context for the recordings and the way they've shaped our understandings of Mardi Gras Indian culture. The first sound recording of Mardi Gras Indian music happened in 1938 in a recording session that I imagine I don't have to introduce to many of you, when Jelly Roll Morton visited the Library of Congress and sang a snippet of a traditional Mardi Gras Indian chant to Alan Lomax. This was part, of course, of the celebrated oral history session between two pioneers, one of New Orleans jazz and the other of American folklore, that was released, in 2005, I think, by Rounder Records in full. And I'm sure most of you also know that that box set is now complemented by another of Lomax's trip to Haiti 2 years earlier in 1936. This clip I'll play for you begins with Jelly Roll's description of Indian warfare, and then we hear his interpretation of a sung chant, if you want to bring that up.
They would dance, and they would sing, and they would go on just like the regular Indians. They would be armed with fictitious spears and tomahawks and so forth, and incidentally, sometimes some of them would break the rules and have some real material to fight with steel and so forth and on. Some even had pistols. And I have known many cases where there have been killings in the city of New Orleans with the Indian bands. Now, here's the way they would sing when they would be dancing. See, they would they'd have a kind of a rhythm with the heels, like this.
Tuwepakiwe is a great example of not only one of the oldest and most durable Indian chants still sung today, actually, but also of the impenetrable language of Indian talk. Lomax thought Jelly Roll Morton was talking and singing in French Creole. His translation then of Tue Ba Kue was kill who is over there. Perhaps he was onto something. More interesting is in the context of these verbal confrontations, the language is very clearly playful and very much ambiguous and context dependent. The first recording of Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans was made by, was made by folklorist Samuel Charters, who recorded a handful of Indians, actually right over here on Canal Street, from various tribes, not together in a single tribe, around Mardi Gras season in 1956. They sang brief versions of traditional chants, including Tue Pakiwe, now with tambourine, if we can hear that second example.
Though
these recordings are not necessarily representative, we might say, of Indian music and context at the time, we can note that the same song here we've heard in two versions is performed very differently in each. And one point I want to make now that I'll return to later in the talk is that there's really no such thing as a fixed repertoire of Indian music. There's a stock, a common stock of chants, about 20, that have historically continued to be sung, but they're always revised in each individual performance. They're adapted by the singer improvising lyrics, the leader of the call and response, suturing songs together. Tue Pakiwe might become Hunane as the song goes on, all held together by the hand percussion, especially what local musicians here refer to as the Indian beat, which we just heard there on the tambourine, the that one-bar phrase, very close to a habanero rhythm, that becomes the basis for a lot of Indian recordings, or Indian performances, I should say, and popular music recordings of Indian music. And that really grounds the spontaneity of the chiefs singing and going back and forth between different songs. The circulation of Mardi Gras Indian culture becomes integral to its widespread acceptance and rising status over the second half of the 20th century when we widen the lens beyond neighborhood Indian activities and these folkloric recordings to accommodate popular sound recordings, commercial recordings of African-American popular music. So in 1956, when Sam Charters comes to New Orleans and does this folk recording, there already exists a host of other recordings by non-Indians, by professional New Orleans musicians in the contemporary genre of rhythm and blues, of R&B, right? So Dave Bartholomew, the leader of the celebrated studio band over at Cosimo Matassa's J&M Studios here on Rampart in Dumain. He's the band leader of Fats Domino, Professor Longhair, Little Richard sessions that are done in New Orleans starting in the late 1940s. His own release on Imperial Records in 1950 with him singing is of an original R&B song he wrote called Carnival Day, and the opening lines that we'll hear right now are Big Chief Brother Tillman, Tue Pakiwe, Humba, this reference to an Indian chant, same Indian chant.
Big Chief Brother Tillman, shoot 24 down.
A little bit different arrangement there, but settle into that because that's where we're heading for the rest of the talk, that kind of R&B funk New Orleans gumbo Caribbean sound. Tude Bartholomew, the renown of Brother Tillman, who he refers to, chief of the Creole Wide West Mardi Gras Indian tribe, was unquestionable. The way he explained it in an interview was, quote, "In the whole city of New Orleans, he was known as the prettiest Indian. Everybody knew Brother Tillman." But Bartholomew's sound recording, again in 1950, is some of the earliest primary evidence we have of the local significance of a chief who carried forward a tradition that at the time was denigrated, feared, and virtually undocumented, though there is some other documentation that I can point you to in the Q&A if you'd like. If Carnival Day, if Bartholomew's recording, was the first popular music recording to glorify Mardi Gras Indian culture, it was an arrangement of a traditional chant made 5 years later by local singer James Sugarboy Crawford that solidified Mardi Gras Indian music as source material for the formation of a distinctly local style of rhythm and blues, which emanated out of Cosimo's J&M Studios. Crawford heard the Indians as a child growing up near the Calliope housing projects, and he created a regional hit for Chess Records by taking the call and response chant Iko Iko and recomposing it in the popular song format of verse-refrain. He added a refrain, essentially, a saxophone riff, and setting the vocal melody on top of a simple two-chord progression. So we're hearing an Indian chant, but now we're hearing it set harmonically to a progression with melodic instruments. Do you want to go ahead and give us a minute of that?
Aiko, aiko, hande, Giacomo, filo, handande,
Yakima Pinani. Oh, my spy boy met your spy boy sitting by the bayou. My spy boy, I told your spy boy, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about hey now, hey now. Haiko, haiko, honey.
That 1954 recording by Sugar Boy inspired a series of other musical adaptations of Indian chants in a New York City studio in 1965 under the supervision of Lieber and Stoller. The New Orleans girl group the Dixie Cups recorded Aiko Aiko as a follow-up to their number one hit, Chapel of Love. You can hear that.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about hey now, hey now, hey now. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anale. Giacomo Finale.
That's actually, I think it's Mike Stoller, right, who's hitting a cajon. Give that low bass part to the Indian chant there. That recording, a big hit, obviously, for the Dixie Cups, which, by the way, later in 1967, Sugar Boy sued the Dixie Cups successfully because of the musical debt to him, regardless of the fact that they're both, obviously, the source for both is oral tradition here in New Orleans. That recording has really proven to be the most recognizable and durable Indian-themed performance, with cover versions by the Grateful Dead, the Dave Matthews Band, Cyndi Lauper, the list goes on and on. It's also virtually impossible to avoid in New Orleans, and you've probably heard it on your visits here already. One version I want to play just a little snippet of to show how long this song has resonated is by the rap duo Partners in Crime, which in 1997 had a local hit with a song called New Orleans Block Party, which recycles the Aiko Aiko melody with new lyrics that give a shout out to various neighborhoods and especially housing projects in the city. You want to hit that?
My girl and your hot girl was sitting by the bayou. My hot girl to your hot girl, I got a hot boy that is fire. Talking about a hot boy,
hot girl.
Hot boy.
Referring there to the ward numbers of New Orleans, the 17th Ward, a very famous uptown ward. In the 1960s, though, taking us back in time to this chronology, R&B was obviously still the sound of the moment, and part of the regional, what was referred to as the New Orleans sound, which Cosimo is so much responsible for at J&M, was also derived from Indian talk, from Indian themes of fraternity and fierceness, and from the Indian beat, that simple beat I clapped out earlier. We've heard adaptations of the traditional chant, Aiko Aiko. Now an example of an original composition that glorifies Indian culture, I'm sure, again, one that a lot of you are familiar with, Professor Longhair's 1964 recording of Big Chief with this just startlingly original arrangement by Wardell Kazare, who's known as the Creole Beethoven, that marries Longhair's kind of insane finger-bending pyrotechnics that's become such a... it's one of these standard pieces that every New Orleans pianist has to grapple with and be able to know. Set to this unforgettable melody on the horns and propelled by drummer Smokey Johnson's funky interpretation, I would argue, of the Indian beat as opposed to the parade beat, which is another related rhythmic cell that often gets confused there. The words capture the hedonistic associations with Indian activities on Mardi Gras Day, sung and written by Earl King in a kind of faux American Indian accent, if we want to hear that.
Might buy a great big car.
to do everything I could. Me Big Chief, I'm feeling good.
By the time Big Chief was being heard on jukeboxes around the city in 1964, the Mardi Gras Indian tradition was in the midst of a major transition. The dissipation of public violence led to a gradual acceptance of the Indians within their neighborhoods and beyond. Young African Americans were being drawn into the tradition in greater numbers, joining established tribes, forming their own tribes. Simultaneously, the social and economic infrastructure of New Orleans was coming under revision. In the post-war period, New Orleans began moving away from an industrial economy and towards a tourist economy based in what tourism promoters call the Trinity, the city's unique architecture, food, and of course music, and again, of course, all of which are associated with the city's black culture, with the city's Afro-Creole culture. This economic shift was conterminous with the rise of the Civil Rights Movement and the dismantling of Jim Crow laws, all which sort of conspired to open up new spaces for black culture to take on added value as a form of economic capital for entrepreneurs, but also for cultural capital for the practitioners, right, the musicians and the Indians. Once secretive and feared, the Indians were gradually indoctrinated into the cultural exhibitions of the city as a kind of living folk art, almost. In the spring of 1970, a Tulane undergraduate student named Quint Davis, who was volunteering at the university's Hogan Archive of New Orleans Jazz, where I think some of you visited earlier this week, Quint curated a campus concert that brought together Chief Bo Dallas, who was chief of the Wild Magnolias, Mardi Gras Indian tribe, to sing with the local funk band. This was the first time that audiences paid to see Indians perform on stage, as far as I know. And it was Indian music, of course, in a fundamental, but I would say elusive way, that provided the conduit for newer audiences to get to Indian culture, if we could hear that recording also. This is a little bit longer example Quint's introducing here.
Presenting Bo Dallas and the Wild Magnolia Mardi Gras Indian Band, backed up by Willie T and part of the New Gators. Thank you very much.
You can almost hear, as Bo starts chanting here, the musicians who've never played this kind of music before clearly trying to find their way, and it takes about a minute for them to get the key, get the rhythms. The drummer's on board now. Willie T's left hand, not quite there yet. Okay, D, he's thinking, D is in D, okay. And now they're off. Quint Davis continued to mobilize the Mardi Gras Indians far beyond the city streets, first in 1970 at one of the earliest New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, which Quint was working with in collaboration with promoter George Ween, and then Quint would eventually become CEO, of course, of Jazz Fest. He also arranged for their first commercial recording ever of a Mardi Gras Indian chant by Bo Dallas and the Wild Magnolias, and pianist Willie T. I don't have time to play that, so I'll just keep going here. Honda Wanda, the song that got released as a 45, was coming out when a Tulane student named David Draper was doing his doctoral dissertation at Tulane. And in the dissertation, he writes, quote, that the song has been prominent on black radio programs in New Orleans and is a popular song on the jukeboxes and black bars. I should also point out that Draper's field recordings are housed at Indiana University's archives, and I'm looking forward to get there and hearing those eventually. He concludes that paragraph by saying, quote, the prospects of commercialism of the Indian song seems imminent. It appears to me in retrospect it was obviously greatly underway, and by the time Draper in 1973 was wrapping up his dissertation, the Wild Magnolias had secured a record contract with the French label Barclay to record a full-length LP that would be distributed here in the U.S. by Polydor, and all kinds of changes that I should probably get through quickly here needed to happen in order for that to happen, mostly to ensure sonic and musical compatibility with funk and rock of the moment and of Barclay and Polydor's roster. The musicians sort of take over the musical direction of the band, Willie T, laying down the tracks first, and then the Indians coming in over to overdub their parts. Can we hear that there? This is the original Willie T composition, New Suit. Oh, sorry, we got one more before that, I think. Just back it up, the one before is called New Suit. That's the next song, Meet the Boys on the Battlefront. Just back it up one more. Go ahead.
Nine.
I had already deleted the song off the CD you've got. There you go. Harmonic progressions, counter melodies and riffs, more complex song structures, vocal harmonizations, essentially a rewriting of a musical tradition here, and yet these adaptations and compositions from Willie T and the Wild Magnolias really intensify an already existing musical dialogue that began long before the Indians were invited to participate, and maybe most significantly the LP leads to Indians for the first time going beyond the city borders to play at Carnegie Hall all over Europe, really now exhibited as authentic representations of the distinctive culture of New Orleans and attached to familiar folkloric discourses of exoticism. So as I start wrapping up here, I'll just read a quote from the 1974 National Folk Festival program, which begins, "It's not often that a folklore hunter turns up what seems to be an almost unknown yet substantial tradition, especially one as exciting as this, but Andy Wallace, producer of the festival, did, and it's here for you to experience. So what actually was the discovery of a local culture broker, Quint Davis, and an international media conglomerate, Barclay Polydor, is here credited to the folklorists in a gesture of sort of rerooting and reauthenticating a mass-mediated cultural artifact." This gets followed up with a very, very popular record by another tribe, the Wild Chapatulis, backed by the renowned funk band The Meters, with vocals by and arrangements by the Neville Brothers in 1976. That was a track we heard a little snippet of, but I'm being waved on here, so I'm going to pass that up and just conclude by saying the Wild Magnolias, Meet the Boys on the Battlefront, which we would have heard, what we just heard, Wild Chapatulis. The Wild Magnolias, New Suit, just like Longhair's Big Chief, Dixie Cup's Iko Iko, are really the most prominent and durable signs of the Mardi Gras Indian tradition. Soon after the Wild Chapatulis record came out, they appeared at the Jazz and Heritage Festival, where they were filmed by documentary filmmaker Les Blank for this groundbreaking film, Always for Pleasure, about the festival traditions for New Orleans. And there's some amazing scenes of the Indians on stage and in the streets being cut back and forth, which really appropriately acknowledges the role of music as the entry point for the commodification and exhibition of Mardi Gras Indian culture. I would argue that the film is in some way enabled by the popularity of Mardi Gras Indian music and the local transformations in cultural tourism, festivalization, and musical mediation through these recorded sound technologies. It was really a process of unconcealing the visual, the new suits, just as it was of unsilencing the music. Let me just cut to the chase then and wrap up by saying these chiefs, a very modern manifestation of one is Donald Harrison Jr., who appears in the latest TV show, The Treme, that maybe some of you are watching right now on HBO. These chiefs who can play and sing music have been able to commodify and exhibit tradition And in so doing, they've shaped our understandings of this very distinctive local tradition. I'll end up there. Thank you. Well, the 1927, little inversion there, recording of Tue Bakoa is really, it's not even a traditional jazz recording. It's really, frankly, a swing recording made in New Orleans using the title of a Mardi Gras Indian chant for a record that, as far as all of us scratching our heads can tell, is not related to the traditional Indian chanting, but a really interesting, probably first reference of the tradition. Chris here.
I would love to know something more about how the Indians are taking this commercialization and how it's affecting their, you know, tribalism and so on.
Well, okay, just very quickly, the Mardi Gras Indian tradition is very strong right now, post-Katrina. A lot of practices, a lot of Indians out on Mardi Gras Day and St. Joseph's Day and Super Sunday. I would say there's a lot of tension over what the Indians call commercialism, and I would say the source of that almost across the board is photography. Because, unlike professional musicians, Mardi Gras Indians have no way to recoup money from their tradition, right? And so when professional photographers take their image and in the mind of the Indian, even if not always in practice, make money from those pictures, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of discourse among Indians, and frankly a lot of confrontations at Indian ceremonies between, let me put it this way, black musicians in New Orleans and Mardi Gras Indians know what a really nice camera looks like, and know what a professional photographer looks like, and know that it's not the same thing as a point-and-shoot camera, and will behave accordingly as they're out on the streets.
Thank you.